ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This is the NT Country Hour on ABC Radio Darwin and the Northern Territory.
G'day, welcome to the program. My name's Fiona Broom. Lovely to have your company this Wednesday lunchtime.
We don't need roads to be restored to then be flooded again and again and again in subsequent years. We need to increase the flood immunity of the road network.
What can be done to floodproof the Northern Territory's critical national highways? We'll talk about that ahead on today's show. And the saying goes, necessity is the mother of invention. Before 1:30, you're going to meet some very inventive top-end organic horticulturalists.
So he invented this little spinning wheel, a little bit the same that you have in the garden where you hang up your clothes.
Kind of like an Aussie Hills hoist, but for basil.
Yeah, I didn't know the English word. In German we say Wäschespinne, which means washing spider.
And yet another red meat record broken. In fact, a series of price records have been broken. All that ahead on today's show. Let's get amongst it. You can share your thoughts with me today on anything you hear on the program. 0487 991 0057 is the text number. Now, yesterday on the program, you heard that seven more Indonesian fishers had turned up in Darwin local court in the morning. They were due to be sentenced in the afternoon. The ABC's Matt Garrick was there for that sentencing. Matt, just give us a quick update of the details of that case that was heard in Darwin Court yesterday morning.
Yeah, look, Fiona, it certainly was an interesting case. Seven fishers who'd left a small village near Sulawesi in Indonesia, they'd found themselves on the high seas in a boat that was barely seaworthy, an 11-metre vessel. Two of the three engines had essentially conked out and the vessel was just drifting through high seas, rough wind, and they found themselves well into Australian waters. They were in Melville Island on the Tiwi Islands. They'd found a bit of shelter from those high winds in mangroves. They were up a creek. Then defence came calling, and there was a defence naval vessel there that had found their location. The defence naval vessel was unable to get to them. They used their one motor once the tide came up to get out of that creek, and once then, in the middle of the night on June 29, defence did manage to apprehend that vessel, by which time the bow ripped off and the whole boat itself sank, essentially, after they were taken in by the authorities.
So they were picked up, brought to Darwin. What were they charged with?
They were all charged with fishing in Australian waters, illegal fishing outside of their jurisdiction. We heard their sentence handed down yesterday afternoon. Judge Greg McDonald essentially gave each of them good behaviour bonds. By and large, five of the seven were first offenders on this type of offending in Australian waters. Those five, They all come from this small, essentially very poor village in Sulawesi, outside of a town called Baobao. And they come from very low education. The judge heard that one of the men had received a grade 2 education, was as much as he had attained, and then it was about doing chores for his family and collecting wood. So the judge has obviously taken all this information into account, and he's given each of them good behaviour bonds of five, who hadn't been into Australian waters before. The master of the ship, he was given a suspended jail sentence that was suspended immediately. So he also walked free yesterday afternoon. We did see one man. It was his second time in Australian waters this year, second time he's fronted up to Darwin Magistrates Court. And for that, breaching his good behaviour bond, he was incarcerated. He was sentenced to a term of imprisonment. Now, that was largely backdated due to time he'd spent in custody in a facility in Darwin.
Which has been about a month to date.
Yes, which has been about a month to date. But because of his past, breaching his past good behaviour bond, he'll have to serve a little bit more time in prison.
What was the total of that sentence?
Well, the total of the sentence was about 2 months. However, taking away the time that he's served and possibly some other factors, his lawyer told us that he was possibly only going to end up serving about a week behind bars. We talked to her outside of court. She said he was very distraught. He was, you know, very distressed to be, you know, saying farewell to his countrymen who would be going back to Sulawesi while he would be staying here behind bars. She also gave a little bit more of the story behind their journey, their fateful journey on the high seas to try and get that illegal fishing in Australia. Here's their defence counsel, Lima Nguyen.
They had really bad weather conditions, severe storms and winds, really big waves out there. And essentially my instructions were that the engine of the boat broke. There were three engines, two broke on day two, and they were at the whim of the weather after that. So they were boarded on the early morning of the 30th of June, and the evidence in this case showed that the vessel that they were in actually sank whilst it was being towed by the Australian Defence vessel.
What is it that drives them out there if it's such a risky business?
A lot of the fishermen who were sentenced today said that they were motivated to provide for their families, essentially. They come from a very poor village that is close to Baobao, southeast of Sulawesi, and their motivation was really just to earn an income.
We saw one of them being a recidivist in this illegal fishing in Australia. What was the outcome there?
He had been sentenced in Australia in February this year, having been caught in the territorial seas for the same kind of offence. On that occasion, he received a recognizance release order with a condition to be of good behaviour. And by coming back facing another offence to which he pleaded guilty today, he was in breach of the conditions of that release order. And so the result today was that the court resentenced him, revoked the first order, resentenced him to terms of imprisonment. They were suspended and the terms were backdated to a point in time when the boat was apprehended. So the backdate was the 29th of June. But essentially, that means that he does have to spend a few days in jail before he gets released.
What do you think kind of a message this does send back to that village and to regions like Sulawesi?
Well, one of the purposes of the sentencing exercise today was clearly, as stated by Judge McDonald, to send a message of deterrence to ensure that fishermen like himself do not find themselves in the same situation, that they don't breach conditions given to them by earlier courts, and that there will be some consequences if they do. So unfortunately for him, he was taken into the cells.
That was the defence counsel for seven illegal fishers who were sentenced in Darwin local court yesterday, Lima Nguyen, and she was talking about some of the factors that led to the sentencing of these seven men from Sulawesi yesterday.
Matt Garrick, thanks for keeping us up to date with that case.
Thanks, Fiona.
G'day, Tony from Tarina, Darwin and Mackerel Online. I am a second generation commercial Spanish mackerel fisherman and I'm also a shop manager for our seafood shop. And you're listening to The Country Hour.
Coming up to 20 minutes to 1 o'clock here on The Country Hour, Fiona Broom with you this afternoon. A text has come in on the text line 0487 991057. speaking on that issue of those illegal fishers who've just been processed in Darwin local court yesterday. This person says, what sort of punishment is this? Bit of a farce again. How will this be any deterrent? Well, water engineers will study the national highway network in the Northern Territory in a $2.1 million flood resilience study that's just been announced. They're going to focus on the Stuart, Victoria and Barclay highways to look for ways to minimise flood damage. Louise Bellato from the NT Road Transport Association says the study has been a long time coming.
We're very pleased to see that announcement finally come through and the appointment of a hydrological company to do that work. It's been a long time, and hopefully the study will look at the Stuart Highway in particular, but also that the consultants will communicate very closely with the road transport industry, as we know very well, the areas of the Stuart Highway in particular, but also the Vic Highway and the Barclay Highway that flood on a regular basis.
What are some of those issues that truck drivers across the territory on those three highways have had, particularly when we get those heavy flooding rains?
Well, we've seen some of those roads closed for extended periods. We'd probably be urging this team to look north of Katherine, because that's where the greatest amount of freight occurs. Certainly north of Tennant Creek is, because again, coming down the Barclay is a important priority in terms of getting road freight through to the defence and also the communities north of Tennant Creek. We'd definitely like to see the Stuart Highway prioritised. We've made that point on many occasions that if you're going to try and get at least one road network that is going to be open longer for longer periods each year, make it the Stuart Highway. The Barclay Highway's got an infinite number of problems because it's built on black soil and swamps lap the road. So that's a huge spend. The Victoria Highway obviously is also a priority, because the workaround is a 6,000-kilometre detour, but also it's got some really dodgy areas that will take a lot to upgrade. There is obvious sections of the Stuart Highway north and south of Tennant Creek that we are already very aware of, but we definitely think that prioritising the Stuart Highway to increase the flood immunity will be money very well spent.
Is this study enough? Would you not prefer to see this funding go straight into upgrades?
Well, obviously, the road transport industry is always looking for more money to be spent on upgrading the road network. But if this $2 million plus allows projects to be prioritised and to be able to convince the federal government about the actual spending that's required to upgrade the National Highway Network, then it will be money well spent. Our concern, and we've said this very loudly previously, is that the Northern Territory shouldn't be having to find 20% for flood mitigation on the National Highway Network. We believe that that should be monies that is 100% funded by the federal government. Given the state of our National Highway Network when the Northern Territory inherited it in 1978.
As mentioned earlier, WRM Water and Environment have been awarded this contract. Have you been in contact with them, and do you hope that they will very much bring the Road Transport Association into this study?
We haven't had any communications with them at this early stage, but certainly Claire Brown and her team in the Department of Logistics and Infrastructure know our views well, and I would hope that they would encourage WRM to work very closely with us. As I said, the industry association and our industry are the foremost experts on every section of that road network, and we want to see the monies that do flow to be spent effectively and wisely. And we definitely want Build Back Better to be the common theme. We don't need roads to be restored to then be flooded again and again and again in subsequent years. We need to increase the flood immunity of the road network.
For those truck drivers who you represent and you speak to, just how important is it for them that we see better flood resilience and better roads for them to drive on?
Well, both for the truck drivers and their employers, it's imperative. When a road is closed, everyone loses. You're losing money sitting at creek crossings or on the side of the road. Freight can't get to its destination, so there has to be extended detours. I made the point about a 6,000 kilometre detour when the Victoria Highway closes and you can't get to Perth or get from Perth to Darwin or to the Kimberleys. That's majorly problematic. It throws out everyone's routines. People are away from home for extended periods of time that they wouldn't potentially normally be. It causes chaos, and cattle can't be carted to market. There's lots of knock-on effects when roads close, but the biggest impact is on the economy.
Louise Bilotto there, the Executive Officer of the NT Road Transport Association. It is 1:45 on your ABC. Fiona Broome with you this afternoon on the Country Hour. Still ahead on the program, I've got lots of meaty news for you. National and state red meat records are tumbling. New deals are being made with China. Do stay tuned. Dearly Departed by Shaky Graves and Esme Patterson. That was recorded live at South by Southwest. We hope you enjoyed that. Coming up to 10 minutes to 1 o'clock here on the Country Hour, Fiona Broome with you this afternoon. Let's have a look at red meat prices now, because they are just continuing to climb. The national lamb record price has been broken yet again, with a pen of heavy lambs selling for $460 a head in Forbes. You might remember that's about $6 up on the previous record set at those very same sale yards in New South Wales just last week. Yesterday, lamb price records, they tumbled right across the country. Victoria, Tasmania, South Australia, Western Australia, they all set new state records, with lambs going for between $450 a head and $301 a head. New South Wales producer Matt Parker sold that pen of heavy lambs at Forbes, and he says the record price came as a bit of a shock.
A little bit overwhelming, actually. We didn't really expect it. I thought we were in with a chance when I weighed the lambs out yesterday. But, we weren't really aiming for it or expecting it, though. So, a bit of a shock.
And 33 head that you sold, heavy lambs, what was it about them, you think, that made them so desirable?
They just had a nice length of skin on them. They were well finished. They've been in the feedlot for 90 days, and so they were well finished nicely. Yeah, they just looked the part, really, and were pretty heavy.
And obviously we've seen at Forbes last week there was a national record set, and then obviously today. What is it, do you think, they're making prices so high and so good at the moment, particularly for those heavy lambs?
I'm not real sure, to be honest. It's just I don't think the lambs are about. Like, it's been so dry in Victoria for so long. And they've always been our sort of competitors in the lamb market, whereas they haven't got those lambs at the moment, so we're winning.
And obviously with the conditions, what have they been at your place in Yugara like?
We had a pretty dry autumn. I bought those lambs off Auctions Plus in March on the hope it was going to rain. I thought we'd get an autumn, but we never did. So, they stayed in stubble paddocks for a little while, and then we've locked them up into a little on-farm feedlot we've got for 90-odd days to finish them, because, we never got the autumn rain. I hope we'd have to finish them on pastures.
That's Matt Parker. He sold that pen of heavy lambs for $460 a head in Forbes. So it does seem like there could be a fair bit of lamb out in the market for buyers at the moment. And if you're someone who likes to indulge in a rack of lamb cutlets, or maybe a big juicy ribeye is your thing, how do you feel afterwards? Maybe you feel a little bit sleepy. Maybe you feel a little bit sweaty. Professor Lo Hoffman is a meat scientist, and he's been researching the quality and the nutritional profile of meat for more than 35 years. So I thought he was the perfect person to answer the question, are the meat sweats a real thing? And if they are, why do they happen?
It's a real thing. What happens is when people eat, they generate heat, right? But some people feel that heat quite prominently, and so much so that it could end up in them beginning to sweat to try and get rid of the heat. Others just find it a mild, feeling a bit warmish. So it's definitely there. It hasn't been researched much. It's very difficult to go and ask people, would you like to be part of a project? Do you have meat sweats or not? But it's definitely a phenomenon that we're aware of amongst people, but people experience it at different levels.
Are there certain types of meat that are more likely to cause the meat sweats, that are more likely to generate that heat in our bodies?
Although it hasn't been researched, it would seem that the darker meats, the red meats, tend to be more causative of this phenomenon than, say, the white meat. And we think this is linked to the fact that the red meats tend to be more dense. So typically, they take longer to run through the intestinal system than white meats. You know, you think about it, if you ate a steak, you feel a lot more full than if you ate, say, fish, because of the different types of protein. And we're beginning to realize now that the digestion rate that the food goes through your whole digestive tract varies. Fish will pass through a lot faster, more rapidly than, say, the meat, darker red meat, more muscular red meat from higher myoglobin content would take.
So if we are someone who's prone to meat sweats, and if it happens, especially when we've eaten a certain type of meat, are our bodies trying to tell us something about our body's relationship with that kind of meat? Have we perhaps eaten too much or the wrong type of meat?
I don't think it's a case of too much or the wrong type. I suppose it all depends on the level that you're sweating. If you feel uncomfortable, then obviously eat less of the meat. It's just to do with variation between humans and the amount of heat generated. So that heat generated is because of the whole digestion process. And then that meat, after being digested, it's got to be absorbed and then transported to the various organs, including the muscles and the liver within the body. So every person has a different metabolic rate. And it just depends on your metabolic rate and how you react to the different meat. I had a brother-in-law who used to end up wearing a sweatband when he was eating because he got into these meat sweats, where I just find, if I have a full stomach and I had a big lunch, I definitely could do with a power nap in the afternoon to help with the whole digestion.
So you said that this area hasn't been researched all that much. Are you saying then, Lo, that scientists aren't running out and trying to get grants to research the meat sweats? This isn't a mystery that scientists are trying to crack?
I think it's a mystery that scientists would love to crack, but it's like everything, it's quite expensive research. And what we typically do is some of the human nutritionists, they've developed a laboratory model, an artificial human gut, as it were, and then they would collect stool samples from various consumers and then identify the microbes that all occur naturally in our stomachs. I mean, our whole stomach is a big a conglomerate of different microbes, and there's always a fight which is going to be the dominant one or not. But anyway, they would then collect that, and then they would take the meat, mix it with saliva or artificial saliva, add the artificial acids, enzymes, and then monitor how fast it would go through the digestion tract in humans, but now using the model. And from there, they would also get a good idea around what is actually being digested, available to be absorbed by the body. And of course, you know, we don't all absorb the same level. And the other factor to take into account is age as well. You know, we all know now that the older we get, our jaw muscles aren't as strong as they used to be. So we can't chew as tough meat or as tough food as we used to in the past. So we tend to go for more food that has already been partly minced or ground up. And of course, that would also influence the state of the food, would also influence the rate it goes through. So you would most probably feel fuller and more prone to sweat more if you were to eat a whole steak rather than a hamburger that's minced, because the minced hamburger would pass a lot faster through your digestion tract than the steak would.
Our interest in this topic kicked off when a colleague mentioned waking in the night one time after eating roughly their body weight in lamb cutlets, waking in the night just in a full meat sweat. So perhaps that colleague overdid it on the lamb cutlets.
Yeah, I think what it is, remember that the whole digestion process generates heat. And sweat is a way that the body maintains its homeostasis and gets rid of the heat. So if you had a huge protein dense, which is typically what we find in meat meal, then you are going to produce a lot of heat whilst you're digesting it. Now, the other thing that's interesting is, you know, we normally have these big meals during supper, and the fact that your colleague, it happened to him while he was sleeping. And what typically happens, we have a limited volume of blood in our body. And that blood has got to oxygenate and take nutrients to the muscles, but it's also got to go to the digestive tract and from there pick up all the amino acids, fatty acids, and minerals that we've digested and transport them to various parts of the body. And that's why if you have a big meal, typically you feel sluggish afterwards, because your blood is being channeled to your viscera to absorb as much of those nutrients as possible. So it's a bit of a seesaw and a balance.
Many thanks to Professor Lo Hoffman from the University of Queensland's Centre for Nutrition and Food Sciences for indulging my curiosity there. I'll leave you to guess which colleague it was who ate too many lamb cutlets. But do you get the meat sweats? We're about to go to the news. Have a think about it during the news and let me know. 0487 99 1057. I'll be back with you in 5 minutes' time for a chat with the Weather Bureau. Plenty more beefy news to come on your ABC. Stay tuned.
I'm Emily Hoffman and I love chasing chunky skinks in the top end. And you are listening to The Country Hour.
Welcome back to The Country Hour. Fiona Broome with you this Wednesday lunchtime. Lovely to have your company. Well, the saying goes that necessity is the mother of invention. Growers in the Northern Territory, they don't always have access to all the gear, the equipment that producers in other parts of Australia can get their hands on. Before 1:30, you're going to meet some very inventive organic growers from Darwin's rural area.
For us, because it's the first season of growing basil, we were faced with the problem of how do we get it clean and then how do we dry it. So he invented this little spinning wheel, a little bit the same that you have in the garden where you hang up your clothes.
Kind of like an Aussie Hills hoist, but for basil.
Yeah, I didn't know the English word. In German we say Wäschespinne, which means washing spider.
I'm really looking forward to bringing you that story on the washing spider. Do stick around. You'll also hear about an Australian beef deal that's just been inked with a major Chinese retailer. $100 million reportedly sealed that deal. Do stay tuned. Let's cross now to the Weather Bureau. Billy Lynch is with us again this afternoon. G'day, Billy.
G'day.
Now, it's been looking very cloudy here in Darwin. Have those clouds brought any more rain since those drizzles, those half mills and mills that were recorded in the Simpson district early yesterday?
No, not at all. So, yeah, the cloud around Darwin's mostly cleared up. Looking out the window, it's almost blue, sunny skies everywhere. Still a little bit of cloud around the north coast, particularly around Nullumbuy. And there is a slight chance of a shower around the Gove Peninsula this afternoon. But otherwise, yeah, nice clear sunny skies across the top end today, and humidity's quite low, which is great.
That is good to hear. I've just told on myself, haven't I, Billy? I can't see out the window from the studio. I don't know what's happening out in the world.
Yeah, well, I'm your eyes and ears for the weather, so that's okay.
So what else is happening? That cloud's cleared around the Darwin area. What else have we got going on across the territory?
Probably worth a mention, Yalara's overnight temperature. So it got down to minus 2.1.
Ooh.
Which is, yeah, very cold. Also happens to be the coldest morning they've had since 2018. Mm. So, yeah, that was some clear skies and light winds down there. We have had some high cloud move across central Australia today. Expecting cloud to increase across the southwest into this afternoon and evening. And then that's sort of the start of this next big weather system that's going to come through. So from tomorrow, we're expecting that cloud to thicken up. So start to see a few mainly light showers throughout most of the day across the southwest corner of the territory. And we're going to get some quite gusty northerly winds, pushing the fire danger up into high. It's also going to be quite a warm day through central Australia tomorrow. But from tomorrow night, we'll get a cold front push into the southwest, and then that's going to push across those southern districts during Thursday night and Friday. So there'll be a fairly decent band of rain that comes through with that. Then pushing in during Friday before starting to weaken. So expecting, yeah, windy conditions and some wet conditions for a couple of days.
And some unusually warm days in there too. So those warmer temperatures in central Australia, I think you were saying yesterday, sort of tops of 27 or so, is that still looking to be the case?
Yeah, I mean, Alice Springs tomorrow, we're forecasting 27, 25 for Yalara. Some places might push into the low 30s, either on the Thursday or the Friday ahead of the cold front. So that's quite notable. The winds are going to be significantly gusty. As I mentioned, across particularly the Lassiter and the southern Tanami tomorrow in the northerlies, and then across the eastern Simpson district on the Friday. So it's possible we might need a fire weather warning for the eastern Simpson on the Friday.
Okay.
And we might also just need some warnings for damaging wind gusts as well for the Friday, given the strength of this cold front. And then the rainfall.
Give us some rainfall totals, Billy.
Not much probably before about 10 o'clock tomorrow, probably less than 5 mils across the southwest. But with the actual cold front and the band of rain associated with it, I think at least 5 to 15 and, potentially a good 20 mils or more.
Mm.
And it's going to come through like fairly quickly. So these could be sort of like 6-hourly rainfall totals, might snag 20 mils around, Yalara, Curtin Springs, Culgera. And this is sort of overnight tomorrow into Friday morning.
20 mils possible at Curtin Springs. That is good news there for the Severans. What about heading up north? Billy, we're going to be presenting the Country Hour live from the Darwin Show on Friday. What kind of conditions might we be dealing with there?
Yeah, so the pattern is we're going to get east to northeasterly winds across the top end, and it's going to push humidity in. So expecting more humid conditions from tomorrow, even more humid by show day on the Friday. Humid enough that we could see some isolated showers pop up around the top end, and really anywhere is a chance. So they could form on the sea breeze as that pushes in, sort of around the coastal regions. Or we might see some showers develop in the afternoon and overnight across inland parts of the top end around Kakadu or Katherine. So bit unseasonal, that's for sure.
Mm.
From Friday and right through until the weekend and even into early next week, it's going to remain unusually humid across the north.
Alrighty, very, very, very interesting weather times for us this week, Billy Lynch.
Absolutely.
Thank you for your time.
Thanks, Fiona.
Billy Lynch there from the Bureau of Meteorology.
The Classic 100 Piano Highlights album is out now. Four CDs of Australia's favourite piano music. Get your copy at abc.net.au/classic/shop.
I'm Jacko Neil Valentine. I'm ringing at Hakata Station, and I'm originally from Calliope in Queensland. And I listen to the country air.
Thanks, Jacko. Lovely to have your company on the Country Hour this Wednesday lunchtime. My name's Fiona Broom. It is 13 minutes past 1 o'clock. A $106 million deal has just been struck between China's second largest online retailer, JD.com. They've partnered with Australian beef suppliers, Coles, Bindery Food Group, and Stanbroke to deliver beef directly to Chinese consumers. The deal includes a range of Aussie beef products, grass-fed beef, grain-fed beef, Angus and Wagyu beef. Ben Lyons is an expert on Australia-China trade relations, and he told Brandon Long more about that deal.
China's Australia's largest destination of export beef exports, and has been for sort of four or five or longer years now, and it's just a another evolution of the relationship. JD.com is the second largest online platform, and is part of that sort of play in the e-commerce space, which is backed up by fantastic logistics. I mean, as to what you can buy on those platforms in China and get delivered, particularly in terms of food, is pretty amazing. We use a lot of those different platforms in Australia, but for sort of dry goods, if you like, not perishables. But it's a sign of evolving that market for the Chinese consumer.
What do you think JD has chosen those three players?
Well, they've got a remarkable amount of choice in Australia, and in terms of beef exporters, we export 70-75% of our beef product. And we've got some of the best processing and consumer-facing product in the world, particularly in terms of our genetics and different cuts available to consumers. I think this is as much about securing consistent supply, particularly consistent supply at a at a premium price. There's a lot of red meat protein going into China, particularly from Latin America, but Australia is well placed to service that market, being in a similar time zone and less of a challenge logistically.
And quite often when we hear these stories about China and Australian beef, the companies often go quiet. Why do you think that is?
Oh, it's just everyday business, I suppose, for these people, Brandon, for these exporters. It's China has a, wants to, in President Xi's words, wants to hold its rice bowl with its own hands. So it's not a, it's something they want to. We've had ups and downs with China, as you've reported on in the last sort of 5 years, particularly since the beginning of COVID. I mean, it's a complex thing, but this China trade paradigm, beef as we know it, along with barley and red wine, have had some challenges. And, it sounds easy to do, but it is a challenge to deal every day on the China front. You've got not only the pricing aspect, but also delivery of a perishable product, any holds up in customs or any delays in that, or breaks in the chain can really threaten the viability of that trade. So I think it's great that we've got a new attitude towards China, the less belligerent, more practical or pragmatic attitude. We have things that the Chinese society needs, community and end users need. They've got their own domestic challenges as well. There's been I was just in Beijing last week, Brandon, and last year I did a visit over there to Shanghai and some other provinces as well, and there's some real challenges in the domestic economy, particularly around housing and real estate prices and the drops from 2 or 3 years ago. That's put a bit of a change on the dynamics of the Chinese consumer spend and spending habits.
You've frequented China and have been doing some research in that area. What can you tell us about some of that work you've been doing?
Well, it's largely been with some colleagues at the University of Queensland. We've been looking at the recent history of dairy, grains, livestock feed imports, as well as beef, and just looking at some of the Chinese import policies, what drives those policies, what can cause some of the disruptions in trade, if you like. Some people took it as a really political move, particularly on the barley front and the wine front, but the research would show that there's been other domestic sort of production issues and other policy issues, more targeting domestic and looking at domestic self-sufficiency that would probably be more to blame, if you like, or more of a reason for that disruption. And, you know, there's a real lack of policy intelligence, particularly around food and agri, from an Australian perspective of what's going on in China. And I think that's, you know, we've been trying to bridge that gap.
That's Ben Lyons. He's a professor of regional development at the University of Southern Queensland. He was speaking there with Brandon Long. Some very interesting developments going on with Aussie beef and China. 18 minutes past one on the Country Hour. Fiona Broom with you this afternoon. In just a moment, I'm going to take you to an organic horticultural operation in the Darwin area. But first, let's have some Troy Cassadaly and Paul Kelly with Freedom Ride. Troy Cassadaly and Paul Kelly there with Freedom Ride. Now, growing organic veggies in the Top End is no easy task. It can take a while to figure out the best mix of crops to focus on and how to best keep those pests away. But one herb is going gangbusters right now for some organic growers in the Darwin rural area.
I'm Steph from Organic AG. We are currently at Middle Point. We grow on about 11 hectares this year, different organic vegetables. Organic farming basically means that we don't use any herbicides, pesticides, any chemicals. So everything that you eat has never been touched by chemicals. It's just nature.
In the Northern Territory, there are a lot of unique climatic conditions and different pests. There's a bit of a case of trial and error when it comes to which crops to focus on. I know you've got a diverse range from leafy greens to fruit and veggies.
Yeah, definitely. When I first started Organic Ag, did a lot of different vegetables, and over the years we kind of crystallize which works best in what time frame. So yeah, it took a few years to understand what grows when the best and also makes you some money, because that's farming about as well. It's a business and you still got to make it work somehow.
What has been the most viable in terms of the crops that you've worked with here?
I think, to be honest, it's a combination of them all. The thing is that it's a bit like going to a supermarket. When you go to a supermarket and you can only buy zucchinis, it doesn't really work. You want a bit of a range. So for us at the moment, it works best if we have a range of about five, six different crops. We can kind of manage each individual crop, and we can spend some time in understanding how they grow best, what they need. So it's a combination of a few.
And you've trialed some other crops in the wet season as well. Have any of those been successful?
Short answer, not really. We tried some pawpaws, we tried some ginger, but in the end, because now the insect pressure is still there, but in the wet season it's just on a completely different scale, because everything is alive, everything wants food, everything is buzzing and eating, and then the pressure is getting too high if you just do organic.
What kind of pest control methods can you use?
Build your soil. The better your soil is, the better your plant reacts to any disease, any threat at all. That's honestly it. Because we don't use any netting. We have a big problem with wild pigs that ate probably half of this watermelon patch. So what do you do with wild pigs? It's a, you know, we put in a fence just to try to give it a bit of damage control. But in the end, yeah, it's farming. It's a big gamble.
You're trialing a new crop of basil. Is that sort of a focus for you this year?
It's one of the focus points this year. It's still understanding the ropes of handling everything at the same time in a really short amount of time, because as we mentioned, the climate is so harsh and there's only a few months that we really grow in. This season we added basil on compared to the last season because it's such a strong herb and we see a lot of potential there to not only sell it interstate but also get into the local supermarkets and just have a beautiful product, because a lot of herbs get actually bought in from everywhere, but this is one thing we can grow really well. It would be great to have it here in local Darwin supermarkets as well.
Is there anything special you have to do in terms of fertilising the soil or keeping pests at bay when it comes to basil, or is it quite easy to grow here in the territory?
It's always, again, you have to feed your soil as well, definitely. But compared to the other crops, basil is really thirsty. It needs a lot of water. If you have a good baseline, we added a little bit of potassium afterwards because we could see that the leaves got a little bit yellow and that gave them the extra boost.
How much basil are you predicting to grow this year?
Good question. We were predicting every couple weeks about 1,500 bunches, which is quite a lot. We might scale that a little bit back. But it's all, like you said at the beginning, it's a bit trial and error. It's a new crop that we want to incorporate in our routine and in our system. And for that, you just have to start somewhere and then see how it goes and learn by doing, literally.
We're looking at a sort of hanging carousel of bunches of basil behind us. What's going on here?
Yeah, so Bluey is amazing in inventing tools, anything that the farm needs. So for us, because it's the first season of growing basil, we were faced with the problem of how do we get it clean and then how do we dry it? Because before you sleeve it and put it into a box, the basil has to be dry, otherwise it goes moldy or yucky. So he invented this little spinning wheel, a little bit the same that you have in the garden where you hang up your clothes that spins in the wind.
Kind of like an Aussie Hills hoist, but for basil.
Yeah, I didn't know the English word. In German we say Wäschespinne, which means washing spider. So that's what we have here.
That's a pretty apt description. It looks a bit like a spider.
I know, Germans are very interesting with their words. But yeah, and that works actually really well, because now we hang the basil bunches upside down so that the roots stick up in the air and the rest of the plant just hangs down and drips dry with the wind.
What do you love about organic farming?
I love it personally because I think the human has a body to work with it, and being outside, using the body, doing physical things, doing hard things can be challenging, but it's also so, so, so rewarding. And at the same time, I always say when I started doing farming that I started doing farming because I couldn't imagine anything better than growing grapefruit, as cheesy as it sounds. But I think there's not enough of that in the world, and organic food kind of does that.
That's Stephanie Voss from Organic AG speaking with our reporter Sam Parry. That is all the time we have on the Country Hour today. You can catch up on any shows that you've missed on the ABC Listen app. If you want some more rural news as well, you can head online, abc.net.au/rural. I've had a text on the text line just wondering when Matthew is back. Can confirm Matt Brown will be back on your radio tomorrow. Arvo's with Jessong is up next. I'm Fiona Broom. Thanks for your company. Keep it rural.